Hi, everybody, and welcome to Lecture 30 in this American History program of History at Our House for the junior and senior high class. Today's lecture is the tidal wave of exploration that was initiated by discovery of America by Columbus. So yesterday we looked closely at this powerful significance of Christopher Columbus's voyage from 1492. It was a voyage that completely changed the world. It set the world on a path that brought about globalization and America-centrism, both of which are completely unique in the 5,000 years of recorded human history that we know of. So, for this reason, rather than on a simply factual basis of looking at the various stories from the past and looking at different things that have happened, but primarily for the reason of the connection that exists, powerful connection that exists between the actions of Christopher Columbus and the world as we see it around us. That's why I choose to designate the actions of Christopher Columbus in 1492 as the discovery of America. We know that on a purely factual basis, there were multiple different kinds of discoveries, qualitatively different kinds of discoveries over time by different people at different points. Which one of them matters? Qualitatively, to a degree, an impossibly greater degree than any of the others, is that discovery of Christopher Columbus. It is the discovery among all the others that matters. The others pale by comparison to such a degree that it really is shocking that anybody would even consider that they need to be mentioned in the same breath. So, in this class, we refer to the event of 1492 as Christopher Columbus discovers America. Now our task is to see what happened in the years after 1492. As the title of today's lecture suggests, there was a tidal wave of exploration. We enter into the peak period of this transformative phase that is called the Age of Discovery. The Portuguese efforts from 1415 up to 1492, they were definitely valuable, and they are definitely have an important role to play in the story. But those were baby steps being taken early on in a very tentative way. Once Christopher Columbus has revealed the New World, then there starts to be a much more rapid movement, much more dynamic phase of action on the part of European leaders. So that's what we're going to look at now. So, what was driving all of this? I think it's important to name up front what the Europeans were trying to do. And then we can see how kind of what Christopher Columbus did really triggered this new phase of action on the part of many different kingdoms in Europe, basically. The main thing that they were trying to do was get to Asia. That's number one. That is the top priority of the Age of Discovery. Get to Asia. And we're going to see that this just keeps on being the priority. It never stops being the priority, no matter what else happens in the Americas. In a sense, everything that happens in the Americas is kind of an afterthought to Europeans. They were never particularly interested in what was here. When they were talking, the people that they found who were definitely primitive by comparison, or any of the products that they found here as well. And some of them are pretty fascinating from a number of points of view. For instance, one of the things that Christopher Columbus brought back after his first voyage was sugar. So, you know, in Europe, you didn't have sugar. It's just kind of a strange thought. It's always kind of fascinating to look back and realize little things that we take for granted and that are just such an obvious part of the globalized life that we live, people didn't have them before. And why do they not have them? Well, sugar comes from sugarcane. And, well, where do you find that? In the Caribbean. And so if you wanted to sweeten something back in ancient Europe, you had to use something else, such as honey. But basically, Christopher Columbus is bringing back sugar. I think he's also bringing back potatoes of some kind, which didn't exist in the European diet before then. And he's bringing back tobacco as well, which, from a modern perspective, people are not so happy that he did, because the natives smoked. And nowadays, given our modern scientific knowledge of health, we realize it's very unhealthy. But nonetheless, tobacco was brought back to Europe and set off a kind of fad with regard to smoking, which, as we're going to see, it turns out to be quite important for American history. The story of tobacco is very important in American history. So those things definitely are important, but to the Europeans of the time, they weren't. The Europeans of the time, there was one absolute top priority, and that was getting to Asia. And then after that, there was a secondary priority, which was, if possible, find gold or silver. Which is why, going back to the painting that we had in History Through Art last time, good idea to sneak another peek at it here today. These are reasons, more reasons why I love this painting. Because they reveal, I think this artist has managed to capture so many revealing traits of the people of the time, of the events, of their significance, and so on. All of them injected into the painting. For instance, with regard to the Spanish and their priority of reaching Asia, I think you can see that in this painting. Does anybody kind of glean from the characterizations of this painting how the artist has captured that particular priority? The fact that the Spanish are really very interested in Asia rather than what they find here. Where is that in this? I know this is not History Through Art class, but no reason not to go back and look at it again and be reminded. Where is it, Keen?
I think you can interpret it in the way that most of the group is standing around. Now, we said they're also kind of displeased that they have to wait for Columbus to claim this land and, you know, be so reverent. But anyway, I think also they're looking around, they're saying, this doesn't seem like Asia. We're not landing at a port city where we can start trading. We're not where we want to be.
Yeah, exactly. Especially this guy here is kind of, I see him looking off into the distance thinking, this is boring. I'm not impressed, right? And of course, the guy here looking down at the hat is, like you were saying, kind of disdainful of Columbus's reverent approach to this moment. But this guy over here, I think in particular, is the character that represents the indifference of the Spanish to the Americas. In a fundamental sense, they didn't care. The best way to get money, the way they knew, to get wealth, was to be the middleman in trade. So if he's looking around thinking like you say, Keane, there's no port here. What's the big deal? This is a waste of time. Find me an established civilization that we can trade with. Otherwise, you're wasting my time. Now, the other characterization in this painting that I think is accurate and fun in this painting is these characters back here. If we interpret their actions in light of what we've learned, that basically another major priority of the Spanish was to simply find gold or silver, then it becomes obvious what these characters are doing in the painting. They've arrived on the beach, and something catches their eye, and they dive for it, right? With that obsessive desire to find some gold or silver. And it's a desire that is hard to kind of figure out from our perspective today. It's very interesting. Today, we do not use gold and silver as money. That's a complicated notion to trace and to understand what's going on. But today, interestingly, this is a little bit of an aside, but for the past 40 years, human beings have not used gold and silver as money. And that is the only time in history that they have not. So, little known fact for those of you running around with paper dollars in your wallet, and little debit cards and credit cards and all that kind of stuff, and you make your purchases on Amazon and you pass electrons over to somebody. Little known fact, but for only 40 years, human beings in all of recorded history have human beings not used gold and silver as money. So there's another fascinating thing about the world that we live in today that makes it a little bit hard for us to understand. Why would the Spanish and Portuguese and everybody else in Europe be so obsessed with gold and silver? Because today we have kind of broken with that tradition. And we have something very interesting going on today. And some of you might be more aware of it than others. And a lot of people are predicting that breaking with gold and silver is a bad idea. And that the fact nowadays is that our money is under the control of governments. And they print it. And they conjure it out of thin air. And that seems to be, in a lot of people's opinion, and mine too, a dangerous experiment. And it's going to be an interesting thing to observe over time. What happens now that we don't use gold and silver as money? But anyway, that's not really critical to understanding the Spanish and Portuguese. Back in times other than the past 40 years, what was common for people to do as they were trading was either to barter, which means give value for value directly, trade a glass of milk for a glass of orange juice, trade a chicken for a sweater, trade, you know, some labor on a house for labor to build a cart, and so on and so forth. Make really direct trades, or to accept instead of gold and silver, because one of the attributes of gold and silver is that they are essentially indestructible. And so they are beautiful metals, can be used for all kinds of purposes, such as jewelry. But they don't fundamentally, they're unreactive substances. So if you have gold, it doesn't rust. It doesn't really change, over time. And so it's quite permanent. And so as a result, as a function of money, that's called a store of value when something basically stays the same over time. And so people came to accept, and historically in all societies that have had money, they have always used gold and silver. And so the Chinese used it back then, the Japanese used it, in every culture, in India and so on, every culture had gold and silver as money. So basically, if you wanted to trade with people and you didn't have something to offer them directly in exchange for whatever you wanted from them, you had to use a medium of exchange, and the only acceptable one was gold or silver. And so that was why when you look in this painting, you see these guys acting in kind of a goofy way down here, reaching out for something, because basically if you've got gold and silver, you can buy pretty much everything else. And you could even fall for the premise that just having gold and silver makes you rich, that it's wealth itself, and rather than a stand-in for wealth and a means of trading wealth. So the Spanish were definitely obsessed with that. And that became another one of their priorities. So the Portuguese and the Spanish are both trying to get to Asia, and if they can't do that, at least what they want is money, which you could use to buy stuff. And you got to find that by digging it out of the ground, gold or silver. So now the race has begun. And Columbus himself, after returning to Spain and revealing what he has found, he's given permission to go back. And his number one priority is get to Asia. Number two priority, find gold or silver. Everything else is basically much less important to Ferdinand and Isabel. A distant third would be the idea that Spain should spread Christianity. And in a sense, continue the Reconquista and triumphantly act as an agent for the expansion of Christianity. So we even have that in our painting, right? We have this character here who has a cross, and we see the cross on the banner of Ferdinand and Isabella. So we do have the notion, and we see more of it. And we even see, of course, Columbus looking up to God. So we have that element of Christianity in the story as well, but I would put that about a distant third in the priorities of the Spanish. And so Christopher Columbus gets sent back, and he has a job to do. The job is get us to Asia. So here we have a trace of the approximate course that Christopher Columbus took on his subsequent voyages to the Americas. And so we follow him, if you like, here, on his second voyage, which is marked in red. I'll definitely post this map to the class webpage as well. So second voyage from Cadiz here is this one in red. So you can keep tracing that over here. And you see that basically is a pretty close match for the other one. He went a little bit further south, right, in order to see if there was anything in that area that was new and or different. So he arrives at these islands. I think they're called the Lesser Antilles, something like that. And then kind of navigates around them, goes all the way around here, and then gets back to where he had been before. The island of Santo Domingo, or they called it Hispaniola at the time. And he goes back and he finds the remains of the settlement that he had left there in the first expedition. So it was the Santa Maria that had been grounded and broken, and so he was forced to leave some of the men behind. And so they created the settlement of La Navidad. And then Columbus returns on the second voyage, and everybody that he had left behind is dead. The settlement's been completely wiped out. So the natives have a story to tell about what happened, and they blame the Spanish, and I wouldn't be surprised if their story is absolutely true, that the Spanish were absolutely terrible to them, and impatient to find gold, and treated them badly, and that they acted in self-defense. But basically, the Spanish don't care. It's not easy for us in modern times to kind of look back on a situation like this and kind of cringe at the way that the Europeans behaved. But we have to have some historical empathy and take seriously the fact that the Spanish were who they were. And that when they encountered any threat, when they encountered any hostility from people like this, who they considered to be completely unworthy of any respect, they didn't represent any civilization, they were very primitive people. Once they found that they were hostile in any regard, they were brutal in suppressing any perceived threat. These Spanish people were the Spanish people who had become separate tribal peoples and were enemies of their fellow Europeans. What are they going to do now when they're encountering people that are, in their minds, and objectively speaking, much more primitive? And how are they going to respect these people? It's common to criticize Columbus and the Spanish for for not being nicer, but it's quite frankly bizarre and naive to think that they would have been anything else. And in particular, a lot of these Spanish lords and young knights and so on that were along with Columbus, these were people who now were out of a job because the Reconquista was over. And they had spent their careers at war and were excited about the prospect of finding another battlefield or finding land and ruling it as European lords did. This was not an era of freedom. So they come back and there's this conflict that arises and they're going to deal with it the way that Europeans deal with such conflicts. And because they are quite a bit more powerful, more advanced technologically than the natives they encounter, it's really a completely lopsided contest. Thus begins the conquest of the Americas by the Spanish. And, well, Christopher Columbus is not passionate about that. That is not his priority. And there's all kinds of stories that you can read if you want to get to become a scholar of that period and see, and you can make your judgments yourself about whether or not, in context, Christopher Columbus should have done this or that or what have you. I think that it's very revealing that what Columbus did primarily was explore and leave other people in charge of other things and continue to look, because that's what he was about. So he stretches his knowledge here of Cuba to the limit, finds Jamaica as well, and goes back. And he's looking around. He's still not finding Asia. That's his goal. If he can't do that, pretty soon he's going to become dispensable. Right? Pretty soon he's going to be unimportant. Because this is not a nice time to be alive. Nobody cares about explorers. What's the attitude of Ferdinand and Isabella to somebody like Columbus? Do they revere him? Do they say, oh, you are a Renaissance man. You're a man who's a representative of a rebirth of knowledge. Is that the way they look at him? How do they look at him? What is their attitude to Christopher Columbus? Alexander?
Well, you're this crazy guy who thinks there might be some way to Asia, and if you get there, then tell us, and we'll make lots of money off of it.
Yeah, and so basically their attitude is, show me the money! They don't care about continents and empty places and primitive people, and so their attitude is, show me the money! Get me something greater! I want to become the greatest king and queen, or we want to become the greatest king and queen in the world! And so if you can't do that for us, what good are you? We don't care about the boundaries of knowledge. We care about whether or not we are a powerful kingdom. So this is really important to understand about the pressures that were on Christopher Columbus and why he had to explore. If he didn't deliver, he was going to become a nobody. And worse, as the case was on a subsequent voyage, he would start to be looked down upon. And he would start to be treated badly by the king and queen. Because what are you good for? What are you good for, Columbus, if you can't find this thing that you promised us? And so things start to go quite badly for him, in fact. He returns again, and he's still got a little bit of toleration on behalf of the rulers. They're sending him on another voyage. The third voyage is a really interesting one, because he heads really far south. Again, here the purpose is to spread out as far as he can to try to see, is there a way to reach Asia? And once again, he runs into ground. Now, this time, it's not what he expected. He comes to this area, which in modern times is called Venezuela, and he finds a river called the Orinoco. The Orinoco River is, I don't know exactly where, I can't remember if it flows right to there or there, but anyway, it's a big river in South America. And it's so large that basically the only way that you can collect that much water into a river is if you have a huge river basin. And Columbus realizes that this here is a continent. And it's a continent that nobody knew about yet. It's brand new, as far as European understanding is concerned. So I'd say probably about 1498 is the first time Christopher Columbus realizes that he's done something that he completely didn't know was going to happen. He's found this is part of a new continental region that Europeans did not know. So he's finally done that. So then he goes back to, you know, his original regions that he was in. And again, though, so what? So what? Go back and tell Ferdinand and Isabella that you haven't found Asia. What are they going to say? How are they going to treat you? It gets worse every time. And meanwhile, things are starting to shake up here in the rest of the world. Meanwhile, some pretty exciting things are happening for others. So here's a map of a kind of broad summary of the Age of Discovery. And I'll definitely send this map out to you guys. Meanwhile, some funny things are happening. Actually, first I want to go to this map. Sorry. Just a second. First I want to go to this map. Another one that I made, which is kind of fun. In 1494, following Columbus's second voyage, and given that the Portuguese are already starting to make their way around Africa, Spain and Portugal agreed to the Treaty of Tordesillas. So this was a treaty that said, all right, let's not step on each other's toes. There's a big world out there. Let's agree to take the non-Christian world and divide it up between us. We are the two great kingdoms that are exploring the world. So tell you what, let's draw a line. Let's draw a line. Here, let me get my annotation tools again. Here, you know, we know that Columbus has been to this place. So let's go ahead and draw a line right here. And Columbus is over here. So we'll give that part to Spain. And we're over here doing this stuff. So what we'll do is we'll draw a line. And this half over here, all the way over to the opposite side of the planet, will belong to Spain. And we'll explore there, and we'll develop trade over there, and that'll be our stuff. And then this half over here will belong to Portugal. So, all right, half the planet. That's not a bad bargain to make. And it has a number of really interesting consequences for the world as we know it. One thing about this, which I've tried to relate, you know, with the way that I created these two map frames, right, is that the top map frame reveals the severe underestimation of the size of the world that continued to be operative in the minds of Europeans. They didn't know how big the world was. Right, so when they drew the lines, they were thinking that they were dividing something in a certain way. They were underestimating how big one half of the world is. And so as their understanding of what they were doing kind of came to be revised over time, the truth of it was that, well, the line was pretty much here. Not where they thought it was, over here. And so half of the world was this, and the other half was all this. And the consequences are actually pretty profound for human history, that they had this misunderstanding and that the treaty resulted in the lines being drawn here and here. At least two societies, well, actually, these are the lines. I mean, comparing the two lines is really interesting. There's at least two societies whose entire fate was determined by these two lines, which is pretty amazing. to this day, the fate of two human societies was determined by these two lines. The first and most obvious one is what happened because of this line over here. What's the upshot of Spain and Portugal saying, we draw the line. We draw the line here, but not realizing that, in fact, they've drawn the line here. Anybody? What's the consequence for modern civilization, basically? Alexander?
Brazil is Portuguese.
Brazil is Portuguese, right? A puzzle for a lot of people when it comes to the culture of Latin America. Why is there a country in Latin America that has, where Latin America, from Mexico on down to Chile, is all Spanish-speaking, Argentina and all of those countries. Meanwhile, there's this huge country in the Amazon where everybody speaks Portuguese. Well, why is that? The answer is the Treaty of Tordesillas. In 1494, Spain and Portugal made a deal. We're going to divide up the world. And it turns out that a good chunk of Brazil is on that side. So in the year 1500, the explorer Pedro Alvarez Cabral was sailing for India, and, well, he ended up there by accident. And he looked at his star charts and at his navigational maps and all that stuff, and he said, well, I think this is ours. I think this part is ours. We've drawn these lines, and I think the line is over here. It took them a while to sort out exactly what was what. But basically, the treaty gave Brazil to Portugal, and Pedro Alvarez Cabral arrived in Brazil, and that pretty much settled it. Another interesting offshoot for world culture is where this line was on the other side. So this line here was meant to kind of divide up what was understood to be, you know, the Asia. And so there was an expectation that the Portuguese would have access to a sizable chunk of the Asian market. And meanwhile, the Spanish would have access to a sizable chunk of the Asian market. That was kind of the design of it. And as we'll see, it's going to be a Spanish explorer who's going to get here first, and he's going to think that this stuff belongs to Spain. As it turns out, it doesn't by the treaty. It doesn't. So later on, once this all gets sorted out, there are some really interesting consequences for China, for Japan, for the Philippines, for Indonesia. All of these lands had their history shaped by their interaction with either Spain and or Portugal because of the Treaty of Tordesillas. Some of that we studied in the history of Asia, and you might remember or want to go back and learn about that again. It's pretty interesting. Anyway, enough about the Treaty of Tordesillas. It's an interesting treaty. It was very presumptuous. It was very, almost laughably grandiose, right? You could kind of call it megalomaniacal in a sense, that the king of Portugal, this tiny little country here, was saying, I get this half of the world. And the king of Spain was saying, no, I get the other half. Like, we're going to split this down the middle, so to speak. So, and the rest of the kings of Europe were kind of dismissive of this treaty. And I think the king of France had the most clever comeback when it came to the Treaty of Tordesillas. His name was Francis I. And the famous quote from Francis I about the Treaty of Tordesillas is, "Show me Adam's will." Does anybody get the reference? Show me Adam's will. That you guys are dividing up the world between you. The reference is to Adam and Eve. The story in Christianity of the first two people, right? And so the reverend says, okay, the world belonged to Adam and Eve, and show me in Adam's will where it says that Portugal gets half the planet and Spain gets the other half. Show me. Basically what he's saying is, I'm a Christian king, and aren't we all Christians? And so who says that it's Spain and Portugal that get to have this stuff? So, yeah, not surprisingly, England and France and other countries were quite dismissive of the idea that Portugal and Spain should have it all. Now, they respected the idea that Columbus had claimed this area for Spain, and other explorers were getting that, and Portugal certainly deserved to have this, and they were going to be the first ones to have that. Okay, but England, for instance, sends its first major contributor to the Age of Discovery, John Cabot, in 1497, and so this becomes, this is claimed on behalf of the King of England. And though not surprisingly, not long thereafter, the King of France sends somebody and claims part of it too. And we know, of course, that France and England are worst enemies forever, so they're not going to respect each other's claims. But for the most part, they're trying to, you know, avoid stepping on each other's toes. There's a whole big world out there, and there's a lot of room in it for Europeans if they can go and get good stuff. So they're all gonna start trying really hard to do it. And in 1498, Vasco da Gama is gonna be the first one to do this. He's gonna succeed. So he gets there in 1498, he initiates trade between Portugal and India. And they are very successful. I mean, it's outrageously amazing to be the middleman. I can't remember. Does anybody here in this class remember from Asian history what the profit margin was or the profit ratio was on that voyage? Because I seem to remember. Yeah, do you guys remember that, Keen?
I seem to remember it's something like 32 to 1. Timothy's saying 60 to 1. It's somewhere, I mean, it is under 100, but it is definitely...
Yeah, I remember 60 as well. Alexander, what do you remember?
I remember 60.
Yeah, me too. All right, so that's three of us remembering 60. I don't have my notes in front of me. But I seem to remember that the profit that was obtained on the voyage was 60 to 1 in terms of they obtained 60 times the cost of the voyage. Now, that's impossible. That's amazing. You can't do that in any real business venture. Nowadays, when people are investing their money, they're hoping that they're going to get 1 or 2 percentage points, not 6,000%. So it's just ridiculous. What's happening, what's happening there? So the value of doing this was patent. It was just it was obvious. It was you needed to be in on this deal. So Columbus manages to get Ferdinand Isabella to send him again and again. 4 times altogether. So we see the final result here. As far west as Columbus got on his 4th voyage is marked in by this orange path, right? So he's going this way now and coming back to where he has been and trying his best to find a way past America. But you can't. There was no way. So he died a frustrated man. He died poor. He died essentially rejected and profoundly frustrated because he had not succeeded in reaching Asia, and the people of Europe simply did not value what he had contributed. So, pretty sad, tragic kind of a character, Columbus, in that regard. But he nonetheless, as I said, had triggered this tidal wave of effort on behalf of European navigators. And the final, most significant outcome of it was that Ferdinand Magellan was going to sail around the world. So the Spanish are over here in the Americas. They're plundering. They're finding primitive peoples. They're even finding established civilizations. In Mexico, they're finding these people called the Aztecs. Actually, this temple complex was built by the Mayas. And they themselves had been conquered by the Aztecs. And so the people of the Americas were definitely no different from anybody else. They had started building empires, but their technological development was quite a bit far behind what the Europeans had accomplished. So the Spanish go over here, they find the Aztecs, they find the Incas in these parts of the Americas, and they proceed to conquer them because they've got some gold and silver, and pretty much nothing else to offer. So as far as the Spanish are concerned, they also engage in absolutely frightening things. The most notorious of which was human sacrifice, as pictured in their own documents. And so very notorious things that the Aztecs did. And so the Aztec priests would bring the young people to the top of the pyramid and cut their hearts out and offer them to the gods. And so it was absolutely frightening. And so not surprisingly then, when the Spanish, who are Christians, encountered this type of behavior, they were also quite brutal. And this is a painting of Hernan Cortez, one of the notorious conquistadors. Here he is, standing here, unapologetically torturing one of the Aztec leaders, and basically saying, "Tell me where the gold is." So it was brutal. It was definitely a brutal conquest. No more or less brutal than any other that we can find in history, but quite notorious. So that's definitely all going on and not really essential to the story of America. But Ferdinand Magellan, meantime, is engaging on behalf of Spain in the final most significant voyage of this period. He's going far south because he knows that you've got to get around South America. That's been kind of established by this point. He makes it through there. He gets to the other side and he says, "Okay, I got to go this way now. We got to get to Asia, hopefully." And it turns out that this ocean is gigantic. And it takes more than twice as long to get across it as even Columbus's first fateful voyage. So it takes over 100 days just to get across the Atlantic, the Pacific. And then they end up in the Philippines. And then continue on. Magellan actually dies in the Philippines, and it's his lieutenant, Sebastian del Cano, who completes the voyage. And finally, the most significant final outcome of the Age of Discovery occurs. The world is connected. Every single part of the world becomes now connected to every other part. We have this thread of exploration which links every part of the globe. That thread is going to turn into trade routes and routes of conquest. People and goods are going to start to move with increasing frequency along these lines. The people of the world are going to become connected. So we're getting to the world that we live in. These are the agents, Columbus, Cabot, Da Gama, Magellan. These are the agents of historical change. They are bringing about, they are changing the world that they lived in into the world that we live in. Meanwhile, though, Europeans themselves are about to get a shock to the system. As they are going out into the world, and with one of their purposes being to spread Christianity, what Christianity is going to be radically changed. up to this point, it means the same thing to all of these people. It means the same thing to France. It means the same thing to Spain and Portugal and England. They're all following essentially the same belief. But in the next chapter in history, which is going to radically affect the outcome for America, that accepted version of Christianity is going to break up into multiple different kinds. So on Monday, we're going to look at this next chapter, which is called the Reformation and Religious Wars. The Europeans are going to, in effect, disintegrate Christianity into multiple warring, competing forms. And that's a big deal for history, because when they continue to go out into the world, they're not going to be on the same side anymore as far as religion is concerned. Not only are they going to be separate countries trying to take over the world, but they're going to be separate countries representing different kinds of Christianity. So that's going to be a huge factor in the way that the world gets shaped. All right, but we'll leave that till next time. Tomorrow, back to history through art. So thank you, everybody. And I'll talk to you tomorrow. Bye for now.
Bye, Mr. Powell.
All right.
Bye, Mr. Powell.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Same for interesting.